This WBEZ podcast is supported by Wise, the app for international people using money around the globe. With the Wise account, you can send, spend, and receive in up to 40 currencies with only a few simple taps. Download the Wise app today or visit wise.com. Terms and conditions apply. Be smart. Get Wise.
What's up, Chicago? I'm Erin Allen, and this is The Rundown. So imagine walking outside your home, seeing your neighbors, their kids, their dogs. Imagine everything you want and need, the grocery store, school, work, are all a 10 to 20 minute walk away. And as you approach the street, instead of looking both ways, you just walk right through toward your destination without a care in the world. What's missing from this picture? The cars. For better or for worse, in real life, the cars are there. And looking both ways is actually a matter of life and death. Or at least serious injury.
Thanks to the car, our cities are uglier and more dangerous to get around. Our air is less breathable, and our lives are interrupted more by traffic jams. The planet on which we live, the only one we have, is warming unsustainably. And vehicle emissions contribute to at least a quarter of all CO2 emissions globally, a share of which is growing rapidly. The fortune we spend on producing, fueling, and maintaining cars leaves us poorer. And the more we try to accommodate the car, the more it will come to dominate our lives. Car manufacturers want us to believe that driving is freedom. But in fact, we are trapping ourselves in an enormous prison made up of moving metal cells.
This is Daniel Knowles reading from his book, Carmageddon, How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Right now, he lives in Chicago, and he works as the Midwest correspondent for The Economist. But you heard that accent. Daniel is from Birmingham, UK, and he's covered stories in South Sudan, Colombia, and Afghanistan, to name a few. So he's seen his share of transit infrastructure. Daniel says the way we depend on cars the world over is causing apocalypse-level problems. Now, I know that sounds a little hyperbolic, but when you put driving in the context of housing insecurity, racial inequity, and actual death, you can kind of see where he's coming from. I originally talked to Daniel when his book first came out last June. And this week is National Transportation Week, so we're going to return to this conversation where he gets into just how deeply cars affect our lives and how other forms of transit might offer a reprieve.
What happens when we all rely on cars to get around is that everything spreads out because you need space to park, you need space to move around. You know, if you look at a drive-through, you know, there are lots of pictures of people waiting at drive-throughs in the pandemic and, you know, 100 people all waiting to pick up, I don't know, a soda or something. You know, if they were all inside that restaurant, you know, it would be one relatively small building. But instead, if they're all in their cars, they're all spread out. And the result basically is that when we create enough space for everybody to have a car, we make everything further apart and it becomes impossible not to have a car.
Mm-hmm. Can you talk about what otherwise we could be doing with this space?
Well, housing people is one of the straightforward ones. You know, yeah. I mean, if you look at certainly some of the cities that are most car dependent in the US and actually anywhere in the world, you know, but particularly places like Los Angeles or now, you know, Austin, Texas as well, you know, they've got very expensive. And one of the reasons why it's so difficult to build housing is that we require so much space for parking. And if your way of getting around is driving, then somebody moving into your neighborhood is a threat because it means that you're going to have to fight harder for a parking space. You're going to endure more traffic. And so it kind of, this reliance on cars also creates the terrain in which people, you know, are worried about adding neighbors to their neighborhood. It's worried about welcoming people because they think, oh God, there's going to be less space for me in my car.
Mm. Wow. Growing up in Detroit, which is the Motor City, right? I believed that cars were king. That was not the immediate reaction when cars were introduced into our societies. Why don't you talk about how people reacted initially?
Right. So there's this kind of idea that, you know, we invented the car and pretty quickly, as soon as everybody could get one, we all just had one, and you know, and it was simple and invited. But actually, it was very controversial when cars first began appearing. You know, in the United Kingdom, where I'm from, you had to have a man walking in front of your car, waving a red flag, and you were limited to 4 miles an hour. And actually, a number of American cities had the same law for quite a long time, copied directly across. Around the time of the First World War and in the 1920s, that's when faster cars really began to become available and, you know, were widely used and spreading into cities. And you had this lobbying effort to make people get out of the road. And there was this backlash, too. There was a huge fight. So there were these big protests that happened, you know, in lots of cities across America, because so many children were being killed by speeding vehicles, you know, children playing in the streets and were getting run over. And, you know, and parents went out and they protested. It was like World War One kind of memorial type stuff. They, you know, it was in the aftermath of the war, and they made memorials like they did for the fallen soldiers. And it took time and it took effort and lobbying by car owners and car dealers and various politicians, manufacturers, and so on to kind of create this rule whereby cars got priority in the streets and people did not.
Mm. And so you're trapped if you don't have a car. The infrastructure starts to come so that there could be more space for cars. I'm really interested in how this happened in the United States with freeways. Can you get into the act that kind of pushed this along?
Yeah. So in the United States, the big era of kind of freeway building, you know, began with Eisenhower and the Federal Aid Highway Act. And basically the federal government, you know, they wanted express kind of high capacity roads to connect up the country, partly for military reasons. You know, it was the Cold War. They were worried about responding to a potential Soviet invasion. The idea was that they'd be able to move military equipment. But of course, this also allowed people to get around in their cars.
Yeah.
What the Interstate Highway Act did was it made huge sums of federal money available to states and to cities to build highways. And it set off a sort of orgy of construction. And what was particularly acute in the United States, because lots of countries did this, but I think what was really striking about the way it was done in the United States was that these roads were driven right through into the city centers, you know, so you could drive right down into downtown Detroit or downtown Chicago on a kind of interstate highway. And that meant that they had to go through existing neighborhoods. They had people's homes had to be demolished. Mm. And the way in which that happened in the US was really quite ugly. You know, it was done very often through black neighborhoods. It was done, you know, as a way of almost enforcing or maintaining segregation in many places. Mm.
And this is around the time when segregation became illegal.
Right. And I think you had this kind of unfortunate coalescence of housing policy and transport policy where, you know, housing segregation was becoming illegal, particularly in the 1960s, Civil Rights Act, and, you know, and earlier in some cities, they're saying, well, we can't have formal housing segregation. Mm-hmm. But of course, there's still an awful lot of racism, there's still blockbusting. Mm-hmm. And there was this system of redlining, which basically said that you couldn't invest in neighborhoods where black people were moving into. And this created, with the freeways, the kind of massive rush to suburbanization, because you had federal subsidies to build houses in effectively all white neighborhoods, you know, in new suburbs outside of cities, mm-hmm. and federal money to build the highways that would get the people from those suburbs back into the cities to get to work, mm-hmm. All built through the, you know, the existing neighborhoods. And so you had this kind of hollowing out of city centers. And this didn't only happen in America, but it happened particularly disastrously in America, I think, because of that combination of kind of car infrastructure and you know, the history of racism.
Yeah. We know that millions of people die in car-related deaths every year all over the world. But that number is pretty astronomical in America compared with other wealthier countries. You have a chapter on why accidents happen. It's mostly the driver's fault, but not totally. I know you say that we're particularly reckless here in this country. Tell me about the fault question. That point of it's driver's fault, but not totally.
So I think this is a really important point, because I think, you know, occasionally there are drivers in this country I find that are sometimes incredibly reckless, but actually not necessarily here in Chicago. But the reason why America has got so dangerous, and 43,000 people died last year, and it's been going up, particularly of pedestrians, is that there hasn't been the sort of reconstructing of roads that's happened in a lot of other countries, you know. And, you know, where I live, for example, up in Wicker Park, you know, we have this, I think you call them five ways, but these kind of intersections where, you know, where you have a diagonal. Yeah, exactly. And they're terrifying. And even the people I know who kind of regularly drive find them terrifying. I go through it on my bike. But but the way in which roads are designed in America, you have very few roundabouts. You have these kind of huge, wide intersections where suddenly the light goes green and everybody tries to accelerate through as quickly as they can, because otherwise, you know, if they miss it, they're going to be stuck waiting another, you know, 2 or 3 minutes for the next green. It sets up in a way that if you make a mistake, and people do make mistakes, people make mistakes everywhere, but if you make a mistake, it's a lot more likely to end in a deadly way here. And that's changed in most other kind of rich countries. And so whereas sort of 30 or 40 years ago, car crashes were really deadly almost everywhere in the rich world, they're now almost, you know, uniquely deadly in rich countries in the United States. Something like 50 or 60% of people in their lifetime will be involved in a car crash that results in them going to hospital. Mm. So it's really high. It's quite likely to happen to you.
Yeah. Why are you here, Daniel?
God, I mean, I sound so negative about America when I'm talking about this, but I moved here for The Economist, and I actually think, yeah, I love this country, and I love Chicago. Chicago's a fantastic place to live, and this is my one big fight with it. Mm. You know, and actually, I live perfectly fine in Chicago without a car, and I walk and cycle around, and there's a part of me, I think, actually, as somebody who comes from Europe, that almost, if you guys fix this, we'd have nothing to gloat about anymore, you know? Because America's economy is much stronger than certainly the UK's, the most of Europe. You've got, healthcare is a challenge, but I mean, we've got, you know, we have challenges in Europe too, but this is one where we can be very smug about. It's like, oh, they all drive monster trucks everywhere. They can't walk. So if you fixed it, yeah. God, we'd be really stuffed. I love it here. Despite whining about the cars, it's true.
In the book, you talk about some of the illusions we have around this, specifically with electric and self-driving cars. I want to go back to the first illusion that you talk about, which is that if we widen the streets, if we make more roads, the driving will become easier and safer, or even that if we disallow pedestrians from walking in the street, that things will be better.
Right. And there's this kind of, you know, it is true that you wouldn't want people to be walking on, like, the interstates, on the expressways. That would be really dangerous. But the problem we've got into is that it is very dangerous to walk in huge parts of this country. I mean, pedestrian deaths have risen a lot, and some people have to walk. Not everybody can afford a car, or, you know, some people aren't able to drive a car, and so there is nowhere to walk. And particularly, I wrote about something called Strodes, which is this kind of type of urban development that's really become almost standard in parts of America. I think, you know, particularly if you go to the Sun Belt, if you go to very fast-growing cities in, you know, Florida or Texas, a strode is a sort of, it's a highway that's also a street, you know? It has maybe four lanes on either direction, but it's got businesses lining it, and it's got places where, in theory, you are meant to walk. Maybe it's got sidewalks, and the problem with that is that these kind of roads are incredibly dangerous for pedestrians. And basically, if we make driving too easy, if we make the lanes wide, the result isn't that people kind of drive more safely. They just go, oh, well, roads are really wide. I can drive it faster. And it's harder for pedestrians to cross. Actually, the most safe place for driving, the most safe sort of driving, is the most stressful driving. Mm. If you're really stressed out driving, it means that you're paying attention to the, you know, to what's around you. You're worried you might hit something. That's safest. If you're sort of able to relax and sit back and, you know, chill out while you're driving, that's when mistakes turn deadly.
Yeah. So. Yeah, you have a line in there that says if the road is comfortable for drivers, it's probably the most deadly for pedestrians or anyone else.
Pretty much.
Yeah. There is a racial component here as well. Can you get into the places where we find these really extremely dangerous roads, strodes, as
right.
They're
well, they're very often in neighborhoods that are more likely to be, you know, more diverse, black or Hispanic in particular, often for historic reasons. You know, it was the road widening, as we talked about before, mm-hmm. was done through black neighborhoods. So, and the result is that, you know, the death rate in traffic crashes and collisions is much higher for people of color than it is for white people. And it's much higher for poorer people than it is for richer people. Mm. It hits the poorest people and it hits black people harder, this kind of burden of traffic death.
Yeah. Yeah, let's get into those electric and self-driving car illusions. tell me why we think that's the answer, but it's not necessarily the answer.
Yeah, so if we go on to kind of electric cars,
yeah.
You know, it is important that we do kind of replace internal combustion engine cars with electric cars. Electric cars are a lot cleaner. They're a lot better for the planet. However, what we also kind of need to do is drive less, because first, you know, some of the problems that are not about pollution, you know, traffic crash deaths, the kind of spreading out of everything, that's still going to be the case with electric cars. And in fact, in some ways, it might be worse, because electric cars weigh a lot more in general. They're heavier, and that makes them more damaging to the roads. It also makes them deadlier in a crash. But the bigger problem is just that I think we're going to really struggle to electrify quickly enough. And right now, emissions from cars are still going up everywhere. It's going to be really hard.
This brings me to some of the alternatives that you bring forth. One of them that you really talk about a lot is cycling. You've already brought it up a few times in this conversation. I know the joys and benefits of cycling is something that I love to do. Let me hear it in your own words. Tell me about the ways that cycling can really serve us here.
So I think the reason I'm so much about cycling is because I'm optimistic it's a thing that can really change quickly. And, you know, Chicago in particular, there's already a lot of people on their bikes, particularly at the moment, you know. And Chicago is densely populated enough that almost every journey you need to do is within, you know, 2 or 3 miles, which you can do on a bicycle at least as fast as you can driving. And you don't have to deal with the parking as much. And the city's flat. And now
yes,
we have electric bikes. People getting electric bikes, and obviously the Divvy electric bikes and stuff, which are kind of expensive, but they're great. But electric bikes allow you know you to do an awful lot more than you could do on a kind of a classic sort of bike, and you know you see parents with children taking them to school in electric bikes. You see people picking up kind of enormous amounts of groceries in cargo bikes, and I think you know the main thing that's keeping more people from cycling in this city is the lack of safe infrastructure. And as you say, it is getting better, but there's a long way to go. But I think there's a huge demand for people to be able to get around like that, because you know you could. It's not only a question of being green. It's not only a question of kind of the joy of it. It's also you can save an awful lot of money at the moment if you don't have to have a car, or if you're a family and you can have one car.
Yeah, and also you know there are some problems. One of them you said is the safety thing. I think about accessibility when it comes to cycling. I mean, where does you know say transit fit into the puzzle here? Like what. What are we looking at as far as solutions when cycling isn't an option?
Well, I mean, transit is vital. And the other thing I do write about in the book is that, you know, buses are something that we kind of neglect. And it's very important, you know, to have trains and to have as many forms of transport, I think, as possible. And particularly in this city, the fact that you have got this kind of, you know, the elevated system, it's a real boon to the city. It's vital. Mm-hmm. I use it a lot, and the fact that it's kind of struggling with you know staff shortages at the moment, I think, is a real worry. But buses are something that can actually be used a lot. The main reason why people don't like using the bus is that they're slow. They get caught in traffic, and if you can make them faster, you know, a real easy win for not only Chicago, but a lot of American cities, but particularly Chicago, is that if you have dedicated bus lanes and the buses can move faster, you can, for free pretty much, each bus can go on its route quicker, it gets around quicker, you get twice as much kind of frequency. If say it goes twice as fast, you get twice as much frequency from that bus. Mm. And if people don't feel like they have to wait, if they're not worried about kind of standing on a street corner for 15 minutes, mm-hmm. they're much more likely to get the bus. And then it can connect to the trains. And the great thing about the city, actually, is that, you know, it's a grid. On this, yes. this city was built on a streetcar grid. And up until kind of the 1950s, you could get anywhere on two streetcars, pretty much. And now you still can by two buses. But those buses are slow. And the reason they're slow is that they get trapped in traffic with cars. Mm-hmm. And even though one bus can have, you know, 60 people on it and occupies the same amount of kind of road space as, you know, two cars, they are stuck with all of these kind of cars, all of which have one driver in them. And so... And wherever there are bus lanes, like along Chicago Avenue, for example, the buses move fast and people use them. So I kind of think there's a lot to be done just making the transit system better that need not cost anything, but it will make it will annoy some drivers. So that's where the kind of it will cost political capital.
Yeah. Right. So the things that you're talking about, these changes, people are going to be mad. Right. They're going to get angry. They're going to get worked up. The people, political capital, as you talked about, people with money and power, they're going to wield that power to keep the cars rolling. You talked about some places where the people got past all of that and then they were happier. Can you give me some examples? What effect does all of this have on our emotions and where have you seen that?
So people do get angry. And drivers get angry. And the reason why they get angry when you make these sorts of changes is that driving is already stressful. And there's lots of academic studies that show how much people actually sort of get made miserable by driving. And so there's always a backlash from drivers because they begin to think, if you close this road, I'm going to have to take a detour. It's going to be longer and more stressful to drive. So it's sort of unpopular because people sometimes struggle to imagine that the alternatives. But if you look at, you know, what's happened where I moved here from London, or Paris as well. I write about Paris in the book. There have been these big kind of changes in the last 20 years, really. And a lot more people used to drive in those cities 20 years ago. And it began in London with a congestion charge. So you had to start to pay a fee if you wanted to drive into the city center. In Paris, they haven't done that, but they closed one of the kind of expressways that went along the river and then they closed it on the other side of the river. And when that kind of started, it was really unpopular. There were these huge kind of fears of, people can't drive, the businesses are going to fail, that nobody's going to be able to get around, that it's going to make everybody miserable, there's going to be more traffic on the roads that are kept open, that sort of thing. And it didn't really materialize. And what happened, was people began to switch because they saw, oh, hang on a minute, now there's a safer option to take my bike, or the bus is going faster. And it's different in different places. But fundamentally, yeah. as the cars begin to retreat, other forms of transport get easier. And so people switch to them. And nobody ever really wants to go back.
Daniel Knowles is the Midwest correspondent for The Economist. His book is called Carmageddon: How Cars Make Life Worse and What to Do About It. Daniel, thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much for having me on.
And that's it for today. Justin Bull, Sarah Stark, and I produce The Rundown. Ariel Van Cleve edits the show. Brendan Vanizek is our executive producer. Our theme music is by Louis Weeks. The Rundown is produced by WBEZ Chicago and is a part of the NPR network. If you love this conversation, send it to a homie who you know will also love it. And leave us a review. If you leave the review on Apple Podcasts, write us a few words of appreciation, I'll give you a personal shout out on the show. I'm Erin Allen. Thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you tomorrow.